Accession number 19919, Reel 1.
Captain Linnell, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Nottingham.
Which year was this?
In November of 1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Nottingham?
No, I moved at about the age of six to Newcastle-on-Tyne, where I was educated at the Royal Grammar School.
How old were you when you left there?
Well, I spent my school days and my ward days based in at home in Newcastle, and I left in 1948 to emigrate to Canada.
Why was that?
Well, I shouldn't say this perhaps, but I didn't like the idea of the Labour government pushing us around, and I was invited to go to Canada anyway, where I joined a very large glass company with branches all over the country.
Now, can you tell me what you were doing when war was declared?
I was first of all evacuated, I think one of the oldest evacuees, and I went to a nice home in Penrith, Cumberland.
Were you evacuated with school?
Oh yeah, with the school, yes. But only at the end of the first term there, I left and returned to Newcastle.
What was your evacuee experience like?
Well, I should add that at school I had spent a lot of time in the OTC, and when I went to Newcastle, to Penrith, I was a sergeant, company sergeant major of the OTC, and I used to spend a lot of my time training the border regiment who had been territorial, been called to the colours.
How had you felt when you'd heard the news that we were at war with Germany?
Well, I could see it coming for a long time, because I did spend a holiday in Germany in 1938, and I could see that they were very well prepared. Even the sort of anti-aircraft gunners who were civilians, and they would be training on Sundays and things like that, I could see that they were very well prepared. So it was no shock to me.
Which places did you visit in Germany?
Well, I stayed in Cologne. I went down as far as Remagen with the son of the owner of the house, and through Bonn, and went to Solingen and also Dusseldorf. So I didn't move too far around, but it was a very pleasant vacation, shall we say.
What was the attitude of Germans towards you?
Oh, they were very friendly. But I could see that they would, for example, they walk down the street to a nice house and they'd say, a Jew used to live there. And I say, well, where is he now? We don't know. Which was all there. And then I remember when I came back, we got to Aachen, which is Aix-la-Chapelle, I think in French. And I noticed, I got a little diary, I noticed that a whole lot of Jews were being leaving the country.
Did you ever come across any hostility from anyone?
No, not at all. No, not at all.
What did their attitude towards England seem to be?
Well, in the family was an agricultural student, and my brother at that time was at Oxford, and they were the first contact that we made. Then his sister came over in the Christmas of 1937, and I went to stay with them in September of 1938, and it was just before Chamberlain arrived with his Peace in Our Time, if you remember that.
Now, coming back to 1939, when you returned from evacuation, What happened to you then?
Well, I should add that before I was evacuated, I was, as I say, senior in the OTC, and I used to take these cadets to the local barracks in Fenham, which was the Royal Northumberland Fusiliers, where they would do their Certificate A and have to parade a body of regular soldiers to see if they could do the drill. And I got to know the adjutant and colonel quite well. I was a regular visitor. So when I returned to Newcastle, I called on the Northumberland Fusiliers asking if I could join them. They said, oh no, it's impossible. It's all done through the Ministry of Labour and National Service. So I went down to the Ministry of Labour and National Service and got myself a job there. And before my call-up was due, I was able to register myself. But shortly after that, the Royal Marines put an advertisement in the paper and on the wireless to the effect that anyone with OTC or previous army experience could be considered for a temporary commission. So I put my little file out of the drawer, put it not for allocation, and applied for the job. And sure enough, I got without any trouble. So I joined the Royal Marines as a temporary second lieutenant, and had to go and get a uniform down in London and arrive at the military school, which was then in Devon at the Thurston Hotel.
What date have we reached now about?
Well, it was March of 41.
41?
Yes, 41.
Had you been in any bombing before that?
There had been a little bit of bombing around Newcastle, but nothing very heavy.
Where did the bombs fall in Newcastle?
I think they hit the local school, funnily enough. And they didn't do much damage, though. And I remember as far as I can recall, there was a fighter squadron resting up in the north of England, and they chased all these bombers away. So there were very few raids that I can remember.
Now, what was the first thing that happened to you once you joined the Royal Marines,
please? Well, it was just to go to the Royal Marines Officers' School, which was, as I said, Thurston Hotel, and we were trained as infantry. Now, I can remember also that when I was with the Ministry of Labour and National Service, there were two big Marines there, were obviously colour sergeants who had been pensioners, I think, and they were trying to talk me into joining the Royal Marines, but all they could talk about was big ships. And of course, I was a trained infantryman, so this other thing was far more in my scope than joining the Marines as a sailor.
What was your training like at first?
Well, it was very, very severe, quite tough, and we used to do an awful lot of marching. We'd march for maybe do 100 miles in a week, and we'd do any exercises on the way. But of course, we also were being taught the elementary things like drill and how to shoot a rifle and that sort of thing.
Where did this take place?
All in Devon, all around Devon, really.
What was the atmosphere in the country at that time in 40-41?
Very difficult thing to say. I think, of course, the war was on, and I think that there was a great unification of people. People would get together and work together, and there was a great harmony. In fact, I think it was a better harmony than there would be in peacetime. People were all sort of pulling together and making sure that everything's going well.
Did you have any problems in the training?
No, none at all.
Any incidents that happened to you in the training?
In that training, no. No, it was quite simple, quite easy going, really.
What happened next?
Well, there were other squads there of people who had been called up, Marines who had been called up. And the officers' wing, the officers were giving a much rougher treatment than the ordinary Marines.
Why was that?
Well, I think it was we'd already got a commission. They were trying to get theirs. We already had ours. But what they did, though, they failed about 40%. So they all had to go back to civilian life and be called up. So which wasn't a very pleasant thing. You can imagine mother saying, "Oh, here's Willie here. He's an officer in the Royal Marines," and they have a nice little cocktail, by say cheers. And of course, it would be a dreadful blow to go back and have to be called up again under the Armed Forces Act.
What are your next memories?
The next move we had was to go to the Royal Marines Small Arms School in got near Gosport, a place called Browndown, which is right opposite the Osborne House. And here we were taught to use the infantry type weapons.
Which were?
Well, there's apart from your rifle and your 2-inch mortar, and they had a thing which was a most disastrous weapon called a Boyne anti-tank rifle, which fired a half-inch bullet and had a tremendous recoil.
Was it light?
No, it was quite a heavy thing, and it had a little monopod leg at the front. Whether it was ever used against tanks, I don't know, although I imagine the VEF would have them in France.
Any incidents that happened to you there?
No, not really. It's all straightforward. Then, from there, I was sent to a battalion. I joined a battalion which was the 7th Battalion Royal Marines. And this was between Exeter and Exmouth, and only a few miles from the initial training place for the Royal Marines, which was then called Exton, is now the Commando Training Centre at Lymston. And we were just up the hill, and we would take batches of the men who had been given their basic training, and we'd train them in field craft and that sort of thing.
Which year have we reached now?
Oh, it's still 1941.
What impression did you get of 7th Battalion Royal Marine?
Well, it was a very good impression. The thing was that we were, as I say, putting squads through in this training, and at the end we kept a lot which became the 7th Battalion, and we went overseas shortly after that. First of all, we went to Carmarthenshire in the hills, and we did training there, and then we went out to Durban in South Africa, and we were supposed there to be doing guard duties for the naval establishments, but Field Marshal Smuts, I think it was, said, "Oh heavens, we don't need these people. We've got people up in the desert who can do this job, and we'd rather use them than this." So we were moved up to Egypt.
How did you get on with the South Africans?
Oh, very well. The food, of course, was fantastic. We'd never seen anything like it, even in peacetime. It was quite a change for us.
Any incidents that happened on the voyages?
Well, there was one thing. We were put aboard the Empress of Russia. This ship had been built in, I think, 1902. And, I, for example, had to be on the bridge for the shift, and if anything, any weapons had to be fired, I'd be in charge of them. But the one thing they said, for goodness sake, don't order the 6-inch gun mounted on the stern, because if you fired that, the stern would fall off. And the other thing was the steering gear was by a steam engine with two sort of shafts. And once they got the rudder turned, they couldn't get the thing back again, and we used to go in circles. We were putting bets on would we hit the armed merchantman alongside us, or would they hit us. So by that time they got the thing straightened out, the convoy had disappeared over the horizon. So, and then I believe this ship, which was one of the slowest ships, instead of zigzagging, they took a direct course to where they could catch it with this convoy about 2 days later. And it was said by some that the Germans never sank this ship because it was rather like a retriever dog. It pointed the way to the convoy.
What happened once you got to Egypt?
We had two unusual experiences. One was we crossed the equator. We crossed on about Christmas Day, and we all dolled ourselves up in uniforms and no air conditioning. It was terribly hot. The other thing was, I think we went into Aden for recoaling. Then we went into the Gulf of Aqaba. It was New Year's Eve. We all said Happy New Year. We went into a new time zone. The clocks went back an hour. We had another New Year an hour later, which not many of us saw.
What what was to be the battalion's role in Egypt?
Well, in Egypt, we joined what I call a sandcastle frigate, which was HMS. I've forgotten the name of it now. It was the combined training centre at the in Fayed on the junction of the Great Bitter Lake and the Little Bitter Lake. And we were taught combined operations or the use of landing craft. And then, as the after the war had finished in North Africa, we were training a brigade at a time of the 8th Army in the use of landing craft across the Bitter Lakes.
Then which year was this?
It's 43.
How did you get on with combined ops training?
Oh, well, we had done a little bit of it, not very much, so we got on with it very well. And we went on the invasion of Sicily, and we embarked in three different ships in Suez, or Port Toothy, on the 30th of June. And unknown to me at the time, I'd been promoted captain, but nobody told me about it for several weeks, during which time I could have been killed and not known about it.
But what equipment did you take on this invasion?
The battalion was formed as what they called a beach brick, and this was a logistics assortment of engineers and unloading parties. And my own company, I was now second in command of it, did an unusual thing. We went and married up with an army field company, Royal Engineers, and the men lived together, and I was given the job of stores officer, and I had a big store full of all sorts of explosives, and the idea was that the Marine would give protection on the landing beside his Royal Engineer buddy. And if it was a serious battle, then they'd do the fighting. If it was an easy one, then the Marines were very happy to act as labourers and carry the mines away or anything like that. And this worked very well.
Which was your company?
Mike?
Yeah, which was your company?
Oh, mine was B Company.
And did you have a platoon?
No, I was second in command, so we had about 100 men or more. So I was a 2IC at this time.
And were you classified as a Royal Marine Commando by now?
Oh, no, not yet, no.
So this was 7th Battalion?
This was 7th Battalion, and we joined what was known as the MMBDO, which is the Mobile Naval Base Organization. And
and that's boom defense.
Well, no, we were put under command of them, and they were looking after the defense of, say, Augusta, and with their anti-aircraft guns. They had coastal batteries, engineering companies, etc., etc. But we were not doing anything with them. But in Sicily, we'd been working on the beaches for a few days. I think we landed on the 10th, which was, we landed behind the, or with and behind the 231 Malta Brigade, which is a professional lot of soldiers who had been in Malta, and they were, of course, went inland, and we were left on the beach. But then we were called into the line. We had to hastily go 75 miles up into the hills, to reinforce the 51st Highland Division, which were having a rough time on the River Detano.
What was the beach landing like?
Well, it was very simple, actually. The one thing I should maybe mention in passing was that we landed at night about 3 o'clock in the morning, and the thing to look for was a chimney stack. This chimney stack was silhouetted against the sky, and it made landing aiming at the beach quite simple. The thing that happened there, though, was that this chimney was over a wine factory. And a lot of a lot of sailors, soldiers, and everybody were going to this wine factory and big vat and drawing the wine off, until one day they found a dead sailor in the bottom of it, so the drinking stopped suddenly.
What about that? You had a 75-mile trek inland?
Inland, yes, and we were told to go around the left of the... There was a gap between the British from Catania on the sea to a place called Sfero, where the 51st Island Division was. Then there was a gap between them and the Canadians coming up north towards that area. And we were supposed to go around the left of the 51st Div and deny the enemy the use of the road which was supplying them from the west. But one of the companies in our 7th Battalion was in the beach area, who had been doing the infantry role, and they went ahead of the lot of us. And they arrived before dark and reported the fact that they see Germans milling around on the object about 2 miles away. And our second in command, Ben de Courcy Ireland, had been summoned to the 51st Highland Brigade Division headquarters and to get the orders. And when he reported the fact that they'd seen Germans, they said, absolutely, imagination, there's only small amount of Italians there. So we were ordered to do a night attack down a little mountain track across a little bit of flat plain, the river to Taino, a railway embankment, and a road, which we did. I had to lead this compass march from the bottom of the track towards the enemy, and we engaged them. I thought it was a rugby match, really, and we went dashing in. One of my friends, who was in charge of 12th Platoon, went around the Italians saying, Capitano? No, Capitano? I said, dove Capitano? They said, there. So he went up and shot him. And immediately we had about 100 prisoners there. But then the Germans woke up as it got light, and there was the Hermann Göring, regiment of the Hermann Göring Division in the rear. They didn't attack on foot, but they had all the heavy weapons, which we didn't have. It's like 81 millimeter mortars, 88 anti-aircraft or ground attack weapons, and the 4-barrel 20 millimeters, and they shot us up. But the they set the field on fire where we were behind this embankment. I think the 88s couldn't get down, trained down to where we were. But as some of the Italian prisoners broke, they were shot up by the Germans. So when I got back home, we only had two of us, two officers and 40 men. The 10th Platoon commander was shot through the side, and 11th Platoon commander was shot right through the head, and the company commander was hit by a burst of airburst from the 88s. So that was a pretty disastrous day.
How did you feel about this first taste of action?
Well, you don't think about it. It didn't bother me at all. I don't know why it didn't, but I could have been killed very easy that day and not known that I was a captain. I was told about this later.
How long did all this last?
Well, I think I got back about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we were immediately sent forward to dig in on both the reverse slope and the forward slope. And in the night you would go in the forward slope. In the day you'd be on the reverse slope. But I remember there was no trees, no shade, and I got heat exhaustion. So what the MO did, he put me underneath a 1,500 weight truck to get some shade, which is not very pleasant. Now from there we moved around the Gerbini Airport and relieved a battalion of the Highland Division to do so. Then we were sent into Catania, which had then been captured, to look to stop looting and maintain law and order. And from there, we moved into up to Taranto, and I was given a job of going further north, where groups of about 1,000 Yugoslavian refugees was met at, in Bari by a train. They came down to where we were, forgotten Maglie, I think it was called. And I was very impressed with these Yugoslavians. They were very well disciplined. They didn't move until they were told to move. Then they were put in 3-ton trucks, and as soon as the trucks rolled off, they'd start to sing. So in this camp, we had two camps. One was what we called the dirty camp, and another one the clean camp. And the new arrivals we put in the dirty camp and immediately given something to eat. Now there was a commandant in charge of a Yugoslav commandant in charge of maintenance party, I suppose you'd call it, or staff. And little things had happened which you didn't expect. Somebody would die, so you'd have to go and get a piece of ground and consecrate it and get some priest to come and do the service. And anyway, it was quite an interesting time. Well, after we'd fed these people, we put them through a funnel where they were stripped of their clothes. The clothes were disinfected. They were given a shower, then another meal, and then taken away in 3-ton trucks in communities of 1,000 and sort of sent to different parts of Italy.
Had these been Yugoslavs under Tito or Milosevic?
Well, they would be the Tito ones, actually. But they were, I remember one day, though, the commandant came to me and they said, oh, they sent us Chetniks, they could have better sent us Germans. So there were these, I think the Chetniks, of course, were the Bosnian type.
And this was where? Bari?
Between Bari and Catania. No, not Catania. Just a minute.
Not Taranto.
Yeah, Taranto. Sorry, between those.
Anything else happened to you in this area?
Not really. But then the next thing was that there was a need for another commando for D-Day. And they decided it would be based on the 7th Battalion Royal Marines. So in January, I think it was, we set sail with units of the MMBDO, searchlights, gunners, anti-aircraft gunners, and coastal batteries, etc. And we sailed back to England, or rather to Scotland. We arrived in Scotland, I think it was the 2nd of February, 44. We were given a short leave and told to report at Deal on the 2nd of March. So we threw out a lot of our older people, and a lot of people who actually would have been better, and we replaced them with people from Marines from the MMBDO. And we only had a couple of months training to be ready for D-Day, which we did. Hence the book by General Bolton, who was our CO, the now 48 commando.
Don't worry about that.
He wrote the book, Haste of the Battle, and this was exactly it. We only had these 3 months to be ready and ready to go into on to D-Day. What I felt about the landing at D-Day was that